I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. It's a day and a half since the 2016 election. One of our guests this hour wrote before Tuesday, the day after this election is likely to be darker and more foreboding than the day after just about any U.S. election since 1860. Half the country woke up yesterday if they ever went to sleep, disappointed by the returns. Half of the country woke up if they ever went to sleep, quite relieved. Joining us this hour, it should be a really great hour, the authors of a thoughtful piece in the Wall Street Journal last weekend, A Truce for Our Tribal Politics, by understanding the psychological causes of our national situation, we can all take some simple steps to bridge it. And later, the author of a piece in The Atlantic, also written before the election, Americans don't need reconciliation, they need to get better at arguing. A rush to reunion can entrench injustice. Instead of papering over differences, Americans need to be smarter about engaging them. And I'm sure you're going to have a lot to say about this. A lot of people were very happy with the election returns. A lot of people were very unhappy. How will you speak to neighbors who may be of politically different persuasions? Are you ready to make a transition? Will you be ready to make a transition? How does the country make a transition? And maybe it's too early for you to do that. We'll talk about that and welcome your phone calls for all of our guests. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We have two guests with us, and they are the people who put together that piece in last weekend's Wall Street Journal. Matt Motel is an assistant professor studying political psychology at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's on the board of an interesting organization, civilpolitics.org. It's a nonprofit organization aiming to serve groups and individuals who are trying to bridge moral divisions by connecting them with scientific research in this domain. Matt, thanks very much for being with us, and hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being with us. Ravi Iyer is also with us, and he is one of the directors of civilpolitics.org and Ranker website, and he's co-author of the aforementioned Wall Street Journal piece. Hello, Ravi. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have both of you here. So what do you think? Is this the everybody woke up after an election? Was it the most difficult election and the most foreboding and darkest election and most divisive election, do you think, since 1860? Really?
It's entirely possible. This election has had a certain uncivil tone that is probably more extreme than any that we've had in quite some time, if not the most uncivil ever. Because most of the debates, they really focused on personal attacks rather than policy. And there was a lot of, I think, emotions played a much bigger role this time around than in the past, because some of the candidates, they were attacking people that supported the other side. So Hillary famously was critiquing Trump supporters as being a basket of deplorables.
Right.
And Trump was critiquing pretty much a lot of minority groups in this country, saying some pretty nasty things about them. So people were very personally invested in this, and a lot of people felt personally targeted by both sides.
Mm-hmm. Ravi, you suggest in the Wall Street Journal article, I haven't seen this, but you mentioned the most watched made-for-TV movie in American history the day after a 1983 portrayal of life in Kansas and Missouri in the days just before and after an all-out nuclear war with the Soviet Union. You suggest that we may want to find that on YouTube and go to 53 minutes in and watch the next 6 minutes. What would we see, and why should we watch that?
Well, we just see that life can be a lot worse than, you know, as President Obama said, the sun still comes out the next day, right? So a lot of people have portrayed this election as apocalyptic, as the end of the world if one side or the other would win. And I think it's important for people to realize that, you know, we've made a lot of progress in society. Crime is down, hunger is down. You know, it's not, the gains are not evenly distributed, and that's a lot of the reason why we see a lot of the dissatisfaction that, played a part in this election. But we've made a lot of progress, and the end result is not the apocalypse. Life will go on. Our country will go on. And so it's just really helping people put things in perspective.
Mm-hmm. Matt, if we understand better the psychological causes of our current animosity, we can take simple steps, you say, to turn it down. What are the psychological causes of our animosity?
Well, there are a few of them, and I think one of them is a cultural change that we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years where liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans have increasingly segregated themselves into different communities. We've also expanded what our political identity includes. So it's not just that I vote for Democrats or I vote for Republicans. It's also a determinant of what church I go to, what TV shows I watch, where I like to shop, what kind of cities I like to live in. And when we have these divisions, they strike very deep, and it makes it much harder to talk to people on the other side because we just don't have nearly as much common ground as we used to. So one of the things that happens with that is that we have fewer relationships with people on the other side. And when we don't have that personal connection to somebody who thinks differently from us, it becomes a whole lot easier for us to think very negative things about them. We say, oh, well, I don't know anybody who votes that way, so they must be evil, they must be ignorant, they might be crazy. And when we make these assumptions about people on the other side, there's no way that conversation is going to go well.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's becoming more and more entrenched because our media is reflecting that as well? And now we've got all these social media websites where people just reinforce each other's firmly held beliefs.
Yes, and there's a deep psychological literature showing that when we only talk to people who share our viewpoints, we become more and more extreme in our beliefs. So if we're on Twitter or on Facebook or in a community where everybody shares our views, we're going to become more extreme. We're going to become more liberal or more conservative, and that divide between us gets bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm. What are the steps that we can take, let me hear from both of you on this, Dr. Iyer, to tone all of this down if we want to do that? How do we turn it down?
So we have two main recommendations that are based a lot on all the scientific research that we've reviewed, but also on our experience with many practitioners in the community who bring liberals and conservatives together. And the recommendations are, one, to focus on relationships first. So if you want to build a bridge across a divide, you know, don't lead with politics and don't try and convince them with facts. Start by building a relationship with the other person. Talk about something that maybe binds you or something you might agree on. Talk about your kids, talk about the local sports team. And then once you've built a relationship, then you can get your intuitions working for you where you're no longer in this as competitive a dynamic. And the second thing follows from that is try to focus on cooperative goals rather than competitive goals. So you already see this in the election. You see people trying to reach out to the other side, saying, you know, let's all work together on, say, improving the lives of working class citizens, right? That's something that ostensibly both sides can agree upon.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you focus on the things you agree upon, and there's obviously many things you disagree upon, but you see all the statements coming out of people, you know, yes, I acknowledge disagreement, but let's focus on the things we do agree on. And then once you do that, the relationships will follow in you, and you'll start to be able to compromise on the things you disagree with on more.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Mattel, are people ready to do this now, or do they need a cooling down because it's been a pretty vicious, really, year and a half?
Well, it's a challenge. I think that right now it's hard because this is a very raw time for people. People that supported Secretary Clinton, they are upset right now. So it's probably harder for them to take a step back and try to approach people and talk with kind of cool, collected heads with people that supported President-elect Trump. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. I think that it's important for us to immediately start trying to assume the best in people, kind of operate with the principle of charity, where we're trying to understand people on the other side and not assuming that the other side is just simply racist or xenophobic or whatever other negative things that are cast upon them, because most Americans want very similar things. We want the country to succeed. We want jobs. We want to be happy and healthy and secure. Certainly there's disagreement on how we get there, but we agree on many of the superordinate overarching goals. So if we can remember that, I think that's going to be one big step in terms of promoting conversation and civil conversation with people who disagree with us.
Mm-hmm. And you remind us, and this is true, civility doesn't require consensus or the suspension of criticism. That's healthy, isn't it?
That's exactly right. Oftentimes when people mention civility, they think, oh, well, that what that really means is I want the other side to agree with me and be nicer to me. But in reality, I think that the civility that I want, and possibly civil politics more broadly, is that we want people to disagree in a productive way, because there are good ideas on both the left and right. The trick is figuring out how to integrate those ideas to take the best of both sides to develop the best policies that move this country forward.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about civicpolitics.org. Are you getting people together to agree on things and work for the common good, or how? What is the organization all about?
Well,
so it's civilpolitics.org, just to clarify. We're mainly a group of academics. So, we're basic researchers. We've published a lot of papers on moral psychology, and people started to get interested in our work as they've seen the rising divisions and the application of what we've been doing to bringing people together in their communities. So it sort of grew organically out of people contacting us, wanting to work with us. A number of the people we work with are partners in the community. There's organizations like the Village Square, Living Room Conversations. We help them with some of their evaluations. We give them access to research. And then what they do in turn helps us make the research better. Because you can only learn so much from people in a lab in a psychology department. Eventually you want to take your theories, try them out in the real world. So we're trying to really bridge that cycle between, our research goes into practice, the practice informs the research, and then all of that gets hopefully into the community, into the hands of regular people who might want to apply this in their everyday lives.
And do you get the feeling, the sense, are your phones ringing off the wall right now with people saying we really need this, or what's happening in that regard?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think before the election, I think there was a lot of, there was a lot of talk about civility, and it was a little bit more from like a partisan point of view. Like, that was uncivil on that person's part, and I don't like it, and we should call it out. And there was no shortage of that, and I think it wasn't necessarily a time for us that, but now I feel like people are trying to bridge it from both sides of the aisle a bit more and trying to figure it out. And there's a little bit more of a superordinate goal of all Americans to come together, right? And you see this from both sides of the aisle, and it's not coming from this place of partisanship where we're trying to just brand something as uncivil, which, I'm not sure if that's the most useful way of approaching the problem. So, absolutely. I think it's a national project at the moment, and hopefully for a while to heal this division.
We welcome your phone calls. Our number, and a lot of people are calling in already, so this is good. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We're talking the first half of our program with guests who, number one, wrote a piece that caught our attention last weekend's Wall Street Journal. They are co-directors of civilpolitics.org, a nonprofit organization that serves groups and individuals who are trying to bridge moral divisions by connecting them with scientific research in this domain. This has been, I don't need to tell you, this has been an incredibly divisive election. And is there a way for you to talk with somebody who disagrees with you? Do you need help in that regard? What about enthusiastic criticism of ideas that you don't agree with? Is there something about this election that's made it harder for us to be more civil to each other? Do we absolutely have to do that? What is it about our society that's putting us in different teams, different camps, so we really even talk to people who have different points of view? Our number, one line open, 800-486-8655. And let's start our calls with Annie in Appleton. Hi, Annie.
Hi there. Thank you for this forum. I appreciate it. My comment is this. I woke up this morning with CBS News on, and I heard them saying President Trump, and I actually thought I was in a dream. But then I woke up and I said, I'm so very, very proud that I did not vote for a reality TV star to be head of the free world, that someone who actually thought it was great to watch a bunch of young teenage girls naked in a beauty pageant was going to be negotiating for possibly peace. And a number of my friends are the same way. I've always been an optimist that always thought the best of people, and I think the thing that has hit me and most of my friends that feel this way is it knocked the wind out of our sails to realize that most people really don't care about other people, that they have these kind of prejudices and they do not take seriously the position of president.
Dr. Motel.
it's hard to say that most people don't care. And one of the striking take-home points from this election is that there's a big turnout problem. There were 18 million fewer voters this time around than there was 4 years ago. And President-elect Trump also lost the popular vote. So both Hillary and Donald, they received about 25% of the vote. And there were 46% of Americans that were eligible to vote and did not vote. So I'm cautious in saying that I don't think most Americans really do have these bigotries or these prejudices. Rather, most Americans want to get along. They want to be civil and nice to each other and operate within the same space in a respectful manner. So even though the results of the election might not be what we like, we should not make these huge generalizations about many, many Americans.
Ravi?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't vote for Trump, and I share some disappointment, but I agree with Matt that, you know, there are lots of reasons to vote for Trump that have nothing to do with being racist or not caring about people. And so, you know, and if you were to read the exit polls, a lot of what people were saying is they want to change. And there were a lot of people who thought Trump was disqualified and or not qualified to be president and still voted for him because they want to change so badly. So there are many reasons why people do the things they do. And I think, you know, when you actually, the problem is a lot of us don't know those people. So we can't see these complexities. We can't see the reasons why they voted for someone and not somebody else. And so we can, it's easy for us to develop these caricatures of what that other person might be like as sort of the polar opposite of what I am like or what I believe in. And generally those aren't true. You know, most people are complex people. They have similarly caricaturish opinions about, you know, our side. And so I think it's important for us to realize that, you know, people are complex people. Very few people are really truly evil people. And there's a lot of people who voted, you know, against what you believed who actually you might agree on a lot of things.
Thank you, Annie. I appreciate your call. Jeff in Brilliant. Hi.
Hi, thank you. First of all, I'm already at work, so it might be a little loud, but I just wanted to say that all the people that participated in that past 15 months of wasting money should be ashamed of themselves. Secondly, nothing's really going to change overnight. You still need the daily essentials, a roof over your head, food on the table, transportation, gas, electric, telephone, a few niceties. And if you only listen to Democrats or you only listen to Republicans or you only listen to Libertarians, you become radical and you only care about one point of view. I'm not getting any younger. Maybe change is what we need. Maybe he is the wrong person, but now we got to work with him. And so does the Congress and so does the Senate. And I don't think he's going to sign everything they want, and there's going to be arguments because people make promises. All politicians make promises. He's had his toes in the water since 1988. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. You almost sound like you're at a political rally with all the noise and the button in the background. Sounds like people are cheering you on. Whoever wants to start, Matt?
Yeah, so, I mean, one thing that we need to keep in mind is that our system is built with checks and balances in it. And even when President Obama had a Democratic majority in both houses, he wasn't able to get a whole lot through. I mean, they certainly got the Affordable Care Act, but it's really hard to pass any legislation. So even though President-elect Trump made some pretty extreme promises as he was campaigning, it doesn't mean that he's actually going to be able to accomplish many of them. He can't just unilaterally enact some of the things that he said. He can't do nearly as much as he was claiming. So even though people ideologically disagree with a lot of the stuff that he said, I mean, you might be able to take comfort in the fact that it's really hard for him to accomplish many, if any of them. So, yes, he takes these extreme positions, but we have checks and balances in our system for a reason, and that might protect people from being victimized by some of those positions that he's taken.
Jeff, thanks. Dan and Woodruff, hi.
Yes, I just wanted to point out a few things is that Hillary did win the popular vote. And everybody's asking Hillary supporters to reach out to Trump supporters. I don't hear this coming from anybody saying, should the Trump supporters reach out to the Hillary supporters? Which I find, and I grew up in rural areas, I live in a rural area, and sometimes these people are just stuck in their ways.
Dr. Iyer.
Yeah, I mean, I think you might not see it necessarily from the people in that in your communities, but you know, I think you are seeing. You know, I watched Trump's victory speech, and so I think that you will see an effort on behalf of at least the incoming administration, and hopefully this is something that can be encouraged rather than, you know, discouraged. You know, to reach out to all Americans and to, you know, he acknowledged that, you know, many people disagreed with him. But he wants to be president for all people. So I'm not, you know, as someone who is, you know, wasn't necessarily a supporter, you know, he wants change. And there's some amount of change, and, you know, this is a challenge to many people that that we all can agree on, and that, you know, Trump supporters are going to need Hillary supporters, and Hillary supporters are obviously going to need President-elect Trump to do. You know, there's a certain amount of dissatisfaction with, you know, the plight of the people who have not gotten ahead in the current economy, right? You saw that from Sanders supporters. You know, I think there's definitely areas we can all work together on, and Trump supporters absolutely, you know, will need Hillary supporters just as much as Hillary supporters will need Trump.
It was, you know, it was in a remarkable moment today to have Donald Trump at the White House and Barack Obama helping to start a transition a couple days after this election. The two of these two men just have no love for each other, really. Donald Trump was trying to say that Barack Obama was not born in America, and certainly Barack Obama had some things to say about Donald Trump at that White House Correspondents' Dinner where he roasted him, and on the campaign trail. It's almost hard to take that in, no matter what side you're on, to see the two of them sitting in the Oval Office today talking about the transition, isn't it? It's quite a historical moment, Matt.
Yeah, I think that both today's events with President Obama trying to assist in the transition, and both the concession speech from Hillary and the victory speech from Trump are all signs that things are kind of moving in a direction where people are trying to work together, and it's echoing a sentiment of, okay, well, I might not have voted for him, but he's my president, and I hope he does a good job. Because, I mean, like it or not, we are stuck with Donald Trump for now. So I think that all of these are pointing in a good direction where people are trying to help each other, and maybe we'll see more civility now that the campaign is over than we've seen over the last 15 or 18 months. Mm.
Do you have time for one more call? I know you have to teach. If not, it's okay. Just tell me.
Sure, one more call.
All right, let's go to Akeem in Madison. Hi, Akeem.
Hi.
Hi.
I got a huge problem with the liberal tendency to go and just seek this therapy session when they just got their heads handed to them and they got their butts kicked. We've had issues of race, class, sexism, and all these other things. I have no compunction or desire to understand why people voted the way they voted. I do have a desire to go out there, be active, and protect the people that are going to need protecting. There's families that are going to be separated. There's all kinds of, assaults on the climate. And people sitting there, talking about looking for a kumbaya moment is the last.
You're not there. You're not there. Thanks, Akeem. Ravi.
I'd suggest that you can do both. I mean, we're not suggesting that you give up your beliefs or even agree with the other side or even stop fighting for what you believe in. I think what I would suggest is that, you know, if you want to get to where you want to go, oftentimes it requires some amount. You know, we live in a divided country. If you want to get to where you want to go, you need to learn where the other side is coming from in order to work with them, because the policies that you want, you know, the more you go into your corner, the more you fight, sometimes all you get is more fighting and more them going into their corner on the other side. So I think it's entirely possible to fight for what you believe in, take action, but also to try to work with the other side and try to come up with areas of agreement. And then hopefully that will lead to some, you know, you of getting more of what you want on the policies you really care about.
Yeah. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us. I hope you'll join us again. I have a feeling that your conversation is going to be important for some time to come. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, and the piece, we'll put it on our Facebook page, A Truce for Our Tribal Politics. By understanding the psychological causes of our national rift, we can all take some simple steps to bridge it. We thank Dr. Matt Motel, assistant professor who studies political psychology at the University of Illinois at Chicago, on the board of directors of civilpolitics.org. Dr. Ravi Iyer, also one of the directors of civilpolitics.org. And we are going to continue. All of your calls are still pertinent to the next half-hour discussion. We will be speaking with Eric Liu in just one moment, who wrote a equally provocative piece in The Atlantic. So that's coming up here on the Ideas Network. Joining us now is Eric Liu. He wrote a piece for The Atlantic. Americans don't need reconciliation. They need to get better at arguing. A rush to reunion can entrench injustice instead of papering over differences. Americans need to be smarter about engaging in them. He's got an interesting background. He's a contributing writer for The Atlantic, author of A Chinaman's Chance, co-author of The Gardens of Democracy, founder of Citizen University, executive director of the Aspen Program on Citizenship and American Identity. He was a speechwriter and deputy domestic policy advisor for President Bill Clinton. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Interestingly, our first guest made reference to this being the most divisive time since the 1860 election. You talk also about after the Civil War, the last time the U.S. was this polarized, and what we tried to do afterwards, which we may want to remember now because it could entrench injustice. We have a lot to talk about, Eric, but how is after the Civil War something we need to know about now?
Well, Kathleen, first of all, thank you for having me on.
You're welcome.
It's great to be with you. I think one of the most important and I think often overlooked lessons of the Civil War era is why Reconstruction failed. And one of the reasons that it failed was that pretty much from the get-go, there was this, I would say, rush to reunion, a sense that it was time to come back together and reconcile. And that was not just led by elites. I mean, it was a very deep popular upswelling of opinion. On one hand, sure, that's great. After a terrible civil war, of course you want to have that spirit. On the other hand, those calls for reunion were used so often by whites to unify across sectional lines against blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And against other non-whites, whether they be Chinese immigrants or Native Americans or what have you. And so the language and the rhetoric of reunion was essentially about white reunion, basically saying, you know, let us white people no longer think about North and South. Let's think about running this country in a way that keeps whites on top. And, you know, that fed a great deal of the failures of Reconstruction and which, you know, we all know led eventually to Jim Crow in the South and legacies of which we're still dealing with today. And so I think one of the most important lessons after an incredibly divisive election is not to force fake reconciliation and not to rush to some notion of unity when there are, as there still are today, deep, profound, and in a way necessary differences in this country. You can't just paper over them. You want to deal with those differences in a way that is honest and grown up.
Mm-hmm. And I think that we're starting to learn this, certainly, by the surprise, because a lot of people were surprised by this election. I think we all can agree that almost everybody was surprised by this election. In your piece, you say it doesn't require that we try to like each other. It requires only that we try to see and hear each other, that we feel the pain and pride and hope and fear of our antagonists. And I think that we have heard that as a result of this election. We've heard a lot of that.
Well, I think, you know, I would slightly challenge the premise that, I mean, yes, generally the country was surprised, but I can assure you, I have friends who were either supporters of Donald Trump or who were
in close quarters with supporters of Donald Trump, friends from the Tea Party, friends from the right, friends who have never been particularly identified with one party or the other, and they were not surprised.
They weren't surprised.
They were not surprised. They were basically saying, I've been trying to tell you for a long time that this country, that a large number of people in this country feel like an elite establishment that consists of people of both parties has so skewed things, has so rigged the game, to use that language, mm-hmm. That only somebody who is as completely outside the box and indeed willing to blow up the box mm-hmm. as Donald Trump can save us. And the those people have been feeling frustrated, alienated, unheard, put down for a long time. But with the arrival of Donald Trump, they had a champion. And so people who've been spending their time, I'm not even talking about the portion of Trump's base that is, in fact, deplorable. There is a portion of that base, if you go on any, spend some time on social media, who are anti-Semites, Islamophobes, homophobes, bigots. That is more than, that is a non-trivial part of the Trump base. I mean, this is the first election we've had since the Voting Rights Act was curbed, and the first, and the candidate who was endorsed by the KKK was the winner. So that's not inconsequential. But outside of that, there was a giant number of Trump supporters who are not bigots and racists and homophobes and sexists, but were people who felt like this country's leadership system, this country's elite, had so distorted the game of politics and the system that there was no way they were going to participate anymore on normal terms. And so I think that for those folks, it's not surprising. It's gratifying. And,
right.
And I think the work of now rehumanizing politics and hearing and seeing each other has to begin with, for folks on the left who were surprised to say, why was it that I was surprised?
Right. Interesting.
What was it? What bubble was I living in that this would mean that this would be a shock to me?
Yeah.
Right.
And this all becomes so big because our arguments until now, and now it's changed. You talk about our arguments being stuck in this decaying two-party institutional framework. So we didn't challenge the foundational assumptions about capitalism or about government. And by golly, we sure did. So we need another kind of framework to talk about all of this even, don't we?
Well, we do. And I think part of what we're going to see unfold in this transition and once the Trump administration actually begins, he has a choice to make. He can either just default and lapse back into being essentially a standard-issue Republican president. But the fact is, he doesn't have to do that because the fact is, he doesn't owe the Republican Party a darn thing.
Mm-hmm. Right, he doesn't.
he is truly, free to move as he chooses. And if he wants to, he can move in ways that bust apart ideological and party lines. He could, if he wanted to, start doing things like raise the minimum wage, or he could do things that are actually speaking to the declining fortunes of the middle class in ways that aren't just about more tax cuts for the wealthy and more standard-issue trickle-down economic policy from the GOP playbook. I don't know whether he's going to do that, but if he does, he will speed along this fracturing of the party duopoly that we're already seeing, and I think that could make politics exceedingly turbulent but also interesting.
We have many people who want to talk this hour in our listening audience, and let me give you the phone number, 800-486-8655. Eric Liu is with us, contributing writer for The Atlantic, author of A Chinaman's Chance, co-author of The Gardens of Democracy. The piece in The Atlantic caught our attention. Americans don't need reconciliation. They need to get better at arguing. and let's go to you, 800-486-8655. We'll put this piece on our Facebook page as well, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show, so, because it's worth your time. It's a very good piece. Matthew is our first caller for you, Eric, from De Pere. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Kathleen. I absolutely adore your show. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Matthew.
I wanted to bring up something a little bit more on the family scale and a little bit more introspective. What struck me today was I was encountering a family member who I hadn't seen for a while, and we have a very large Catholic family, pretty much mostly leaning conservative, but definitely a few of us more progressive liberal upstarts in the group. And what struck me and gave me a moment of pause was how when I saw them, I greeted them, and I first went to embrace them, and then my afterthought was, who did they vote for? And what that kind of made me look and think, well, geez, like, when did it come about to, like, who you vote for as opposed to, like, what you actually stand for? And it gave me a moment to, like, step back and think, gosh, how am I interacting with the people that I know love me and support me, and vice versa? So I just kind of wanted to add something a little bit, like that little anecdotal moment to the show.
Thank you so much, Matthew, for calling. Eric.
Matthew, I really, really appreciate that. And that moment of, as you call it, introspection, but I think I would just call it being real and being human and trying to remember that people are complex, and that people we love, this is true in our family too, people we love have political views and supported a candidate that we found incredibly objectionable. And you got to figure out how we're going to live together and work together and be together. And look, I think part of what when I wrote this piece, Kathleen, about we don't need reconciliation. What we need is to have better arguments. What I meant is this: not only what we were saying earlier, that sometimes a rush to reconciliation can entrench injustice and paper over differences that need to be aired out.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think, you don't get reconciliation on the cheap. If you ever do get to reconciliation, you have to begin with truth. And truth-telling means facing each other. It means facing our history. It means, as Matthew just said, looking inside ourselves and asking, why am I behaving and reacting this way? Or to put it in a very simple way, what piece of this do I own? Right, whether I like the outcome or don't like the outcome, whether when I see this contagion of vitriol and suspicion and dehumanization and demonization, I can't just stand there and look at it and tisk tisk. I have to ask, what piece of this do I own? Right, and I think facing ourselves that way, and then beginning to face the truth of inequity and injustice and why people feel the way they feel, whether you're a white Trump supporter who has long felt like you've been on the short end of a changing social contract, or whether you're a gay person of color today who an immigrant or a refugee who's literally fearing for your physical presence and safety in this country right now, we've got to be able to rehumanize this and not treat our neighbors and fellow citizens as talking points or as memes, but as complex people who we have to try to face and have to figure out how to work together with and live together with.
Yeah. You suggest, and I want to talk about why you think this works, and evidently it's worked for you quite a bit. You wrote a book about life-changing mentors, which I would love to talk to you about for an hour sometime down the road. And you've led circles, talking circles, using the question of who influenced you and how do you pass it on, which is a great question to ask. Do we need to be having these kind of talking circles? Do we have any of them? Do we need to go back to the basics of, inviting your friends, your neighbors, maybe they're not your friends at this point, to have those kinds of questions asked of each other?
Yes, we do. And what we need is not a conversation about, hey, let's talk about why we voted for different candidates. Because that's just a recipe right now for essentially fast-forwarding right back into a Facebook comments war. Right?
Mm-hmm.
What I want to do first is have a conversation with disparate, diverse people. Maybe they're your friends or family. Maybe they're strangers. But you come together, and when you circle up like this and you pose a universal human question like, who's influenced you and how do you pass it on? I guarantee you, every time you circle up and you pose a question like that, and people get 5-6 minutes each to speak to that question, and everybody else is there to listen compassionately, radically, deeply, compassionately. You're not listening in order to chip in your point of view. You're not listening to rebut. You're not listening to hurry up so that you can get your turn. You're really present, full body listening. And when you do that and you hear people answer that question and you begin to see, well, oh, wow, this is how this person was formed and why she has the values she has. Mm-hmm. But more than that, you also realize, holy cow, this person who I thought I had nothing in common with, either politically or demographically, it turns out we were shaped by the very same kind of fill-in-the-blank, mentor, teacher, grandparent, trauma, success, early experience, recent experience, whatever it is, you start to see these cords of connection emerge across the circle. And again, this is simply the work of rehumanizing a public space that has become so dehumanized. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the three prongs of work that I talk about in this essay that we've got to do. One is more listening. The other is more serving. And then the third is more arguing. And I'll get to the more arguing in a minute. But the more serving piece is about we've got to start just doing stuff together. This is why I love National Service and AmeriCorps. But it doesn't even have to be through AmeriCorps. I mean, just volunteer service of any kind in a place where you have to be with people face-to-face. And again, you're not talking about you or me. We're talking about a third thing of fixing something. That can be cleaning up this park or tutoring these kids or serving these elderly folks or helping these disabled folks. Whatever it is, that third thing brings us together, and by doing work with our hands, the universality of our hearts emerges, right? And that serving together, I think, is so necessary right now. The arguing part, more listening, more serving, more arguing, the arguing part, to me, is the key here. America is an argument. We can't pretend that we're all going to find some day in the near future where we're going to be kumbaya, everybody's going to be agreeing. That's not just a fantasy because we're a divided country electorally. It's a fantasy because the very notion of this country is about deep philosophical tensions between great competing ideals, between a federalist notion of a strong central government and an anti-federalist notion of local control, between liberty and equality, between color blindness and color consciousness, between pluribus and between unum, right? These are poles and tensions that are always going to be contested in American life. And because we're not a country that's based on one single bloodline or one single faith, it's having these arguments that makes us American. What I want to make sure of is that we have less stupid arguments. that we start engaging these arguments,
right,
you know, with humanity, with a sense of history, with a sense of our place right now, and that we don't just default to talking points or memes that someone else fed us, but that we know our own mind, and that we know our neighbor's mind, and that we imagine ourselves in our neighbor's shoes. And if we do that, let's argue away. Let's keep at it, because mm-hmm. that's the point of American civic life. But let's just be less stupid about it.
Yeah, how important it is to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. We're going to take more phone calls in a moment, 800-486-8655. Eric Liu is our guest. His piece is in The Atlantic. Americans don't need reconciliation. They need to get better at arguing. Somebody wrote and asked if we would have had these shows on if Hillary had won. I say yes, the articles were all written before the election. All right. And we decided we would do them before the election. So, yes, the answer is yes. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Susan is next in Coon Valley. Hi, Susan.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I tried to get on earlier with your other two guests, and I couldn't get on. But, you know, here's my point, and I believe the statistics is right. 62% of white rural men voted for this guy that's president of the United States, who is sexist. He has historically treated women as objects. Now, when it comes to arguing or debating with people that put him in office, I don't think there's any debating. I don't think there's any arguing. That is such a narrow, unhealthy view. in this country, especially towards women.
But then you have to take in this figure, which I wasn't aware of, Susan, which I heard this morning. 64% of non-college educated white women voted for Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
64%.
Okay, and I don't find that too surprising. Part of that is not understanding sexism in this country. And I think it's blatant. And I think having somebody like him as head of the United States of America portraying the kinds of images he has portrayed, there is something wrong in this country. And you cannot debate that.
Thank you for your call. Eric, what do you do with that?
Well, I think, I feel Susan's pain and rage. I think there's no question to me personally about all of the ways in which Donald Trump, as a man, as a leader, embodies all the wrong messages and examples when it comes to decency and civility. That to me is I agree with that. However, where I guess would take issue or take a different perspective from Susan is this, and it goes, Kathleen, to the statistic that you cited, which is that 64% of white non-college educated women supported Trump, right? And I don't think that's because they don't understand sexism. I think it's because, and this is true of people who are men as well, who did support Donald Trump, a lot of Trump voters are people who have felt for a long time that they are losing status, that they are on the losing end of a bunch of changes in American society, economic changes in which the game has been rigged to reward people at the top, social and cultural changes where, quite frankly, a more diversifying country and more opportunities for more people of color and people who have traditionally been on the margins are now entering the mainstream. That's challenging to a sense of zero-sum status, particularly if you feel like you haven't had a raise in 30 years.
Right.
There's anxiety there. And I think that social anxiety about status and about feeling left behind, not in charge of your own life or destiny or future, that can outweigh, or to use a word, that can trump your feelings of distaste or disgust for this man. If you feel like, you know what, I see what I see about this man, and I don't kid myself that he is this kind of outrageous sexist or misogynist, and the depth of my alienation and sense of being cut out of the deal for so long is so strong that it's going to outweigh even my kind of what my eyes are telling me about what kind of character this guy has.
Interesting.
That to me is a wake-up call, right? I don't treat that as the takeaway for me is not that Americans don't understand the meaning of sexism. The takeaway for me is that there are enough Americans for whom something else displaced that as their deepest concern, and that something else is a feeling that they've been, as I say, kind of left behind by a changing culture and country.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah.
Thanks, Susan. Just quickly, Walter, we're almost out of time. Hi, Walter.
Hello, hang on a second.
Oh, I can't. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm going to age myself, but I'm going to be 50 tomorrow.
Happy birthday, Walter.
And I'm also a peacetime vet. But this morning, again, like I told the other guy, the Clinton supporters are rioting in the streets. And last week ago, we can blame this on the media again, I think, for a lot of the stuff, whether you want to call it propaganda and or if you ever read the book 1984. But why do they present Trump as a villain and all of a sudden now the Clinton supporters are rioting in the streets and everything seems to be okay with that? I mean, if Clinton would have won and the Trump supporters were rioting, I believe the media would have turned the tails on them.
All right, I need to hold you there, Walter. I'm sorry, but we're almost out of time. Eric, about 25 seconds.
Well, I think the key thing right now is that the protesters, as far as I've seen, are essentially saying we're not going to take it lying down if you try to roll back progress on inclusion for minorities, for women, and so forth. We're not going to take it. Whereas what people had been fearing earlier, had the election gone the other way, was that Trump protesters might actually challenge the legitimacy of the outcome.
Yeah,
and nobody is saying right now that we're going to have a coup and we don't think that this guy was, in fact, legally elected president. He was.
We got to go, Eric. Thank you very much. I think it's time for you to be doing a talk show next 4 years. And I really do. I do. Go ahead. Do it. Eric Liu, contributing writer for The Atlantic, and his piece will be on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for all of their help.